Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Hello, good afternoon. My name is Lisa Falsco, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. It's great to see so many faces. Thank you for your patience. We are getting some additional seatings to accommodate the full crowd today. If you could please turn off your cell phone, our program today is being recorded both on KSKA Radio and KACN. So if you could put your phone to vibrate, that'll be greatly appreciated for our listeners. We have a wonderful bread basket today donated by Great Harvest. For only $2, you can have a chance to win something from this delicious collection. So if you would like to run by the front desk, you can pick up some tickets. We have a few more minutes before we will draw our raffle. And there's also a few copies, not too many, of our speaker's books today left. So they've been going very quickly. If you want to grab one of those, I suggest you doing that now. And speaking of our speaker, I'd like to thank him so very much for participating in so many events while he's been here in Anchorage. On Wednesday, he was at UAA Bookstore. Last night, he participated in a reading at Cyrano's, and he also visited West High School and was interviewed on KENI Radio. Thank you very much, Ambassador Thompson. And for recording today, we have our high school gifted intern from South High School, Kale Klingenpiel, who will be recording for KSKA. Thank you, Kale. We love having you in our office. And we also have Katie Parrish with KACN-TV, which you can watch on GCI and Matsu Cable Station 95, Over Air Anchorage, and Matsu Digital 33.3. And you can also watch KACN via satellite on Dish Network, Channel 38. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs Council program, if you could please raise your hand. Do we have any new people? Great, welcome. You're in for a treat. And if you like this program, our next program will be on December 2nd, when we will be having Ambassador Henry McDonald, Suriname Ambassadors to the UN, and he will be speaking to us about climate change, forest conservation in the Republic of Suriname, and the way forward. And this program will be here at the Hilton. Now I'd like to recognize any students we have present. I saw a contingency from Pacific Northern Academy. If you could please stand and be recognized. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. And thanks so much to BP for sponsoring the student lunches this week and for all of our program series. So before I introduce the head table, I'd like to ask our guest of honor here to pick the winning raffle ticket.
I won't look.
Okay. He didn't look for the one with the big red dot on the back. He took 583997. If you are 583997, you are lucky. Whoa. Congratulations. And at the head table, to my very far left, is Bill Popp, president of Anchorage Economic and Development Corporation, one of our partners for this program today. Thank you, Bill, very much for supporting the World Affairs Council and this program. And to his right is Mr. Garrett Wong. You may recognize him from Channel 2 Market View, but he is also the chairman of our board. Thank you very much, Garrett. And to his right, I'd like to bring to the podium Tori Allen, General Manager and Artistic Director of the Anchorage Opera, who will be singing the introduction of our speaker today. Tori.
She didn't tell me about the singing part. That's good. I don't know any Afghan songs. Well, good afternoon. I'm Tori Allen, General Manager and Artistic Director of Anchorage Opera. As you might guess, I care greatly about the arts and creativity in this city, but you may not know that I am also interested in international affairs. In fact, my undergraduate degree was in political science with an emphasis in international relations. As a supporter of this organization, I want to express to you how important your membership is. By joining the Alaska World Affairs Council, you can help bring important world topics to Alaska. If you're a member, Thank you very much. If not, please consider joining or renewing your membership and showing your support to this mission. Please simply fill out the blue card on your table. No need to pay now. Someone from the Alaska World Affairs Council will contact you later. Thank you for making programs like this one being presented today possible. With organizations like the Alaska World Affairs Council, we can do more than just study the great culture of learning in ancient Athens. We can live it. It is my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Ambassador Peter Thompson. Ambassador, quite a resume and quite a background. Ambassador Thompson was ambassador to Armenia from 1995 to 1998. He was President George W. Bush's special envoy on Afghanistan with the rank of ambassador from 1989 to 1992. In this capacity, he met many Afghan tribal leaders, commanders, and ulama who remain active today. Ambassador Thompson was one of the last foreign visitors to meet Ahmed Shah Massoud in June 2001. He visited Zahir Shah, Afghanistan's former king, in Rome. Before assuming his duties as ambassador to Armenia, Ambassador Thompson was Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs in the Department of State. Under the Assistant Secretary, he was the senior manager of the United States diplomacy in this area, from Burma to Micronesia, China to Australia. He has served for 32 years in the State Department. Among the awards Ambassador Thompson has received, 3 Presidential Meritorious Service Awards, 1 State Department Superior Award, and 2 Meritorious Honor Awards. Ambassador Thompson teaches courses in American foreign policy and Eurasia at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He speaks Russian, Vietnamese, and Hindu Urdu. Ambassador Thompson graduated from Wittenberg University in 1962. After receiving a master's degree from the University of Pittsburgh, he served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal from 1962 to 1966. Peter Thompson is here today to speak to us on the wars in Afghanistan, messianic terrorism, tribal conflicts, and the failures of great power. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Thompson to our podium.
Thanks very much, Tori, for that generous and kind introduction. I'd also like to recognize others at the front table, of course, including Lisa, CEO of the World Affairs Council. And something's wrong with the microphone, I think. Bill Popp, of course, and Chairman Garrett Wong. And also, I want to thank not only Lisa, but all of the board members and the staff members of the World Affairs Council here in Alaska. They've just been marvelous hosts for Anchorage and for Alaska, and it's just been a joy to be here. Special thanks to the University of Alaska Bookstore, which sponsored an event, as well as West High School, the KENI radio station, and Cyrano Playhouse, which put on this marvelous rendition of The Great Game last night. Probably there's been a number of shows that they've had on The Great Game. They've really perfected it because it brings out the spirit of Afghanistan, and it brings out the very difficult history of the last 32 years of war in Afghanistan extremely well, featuring commanders like Ahmed Shah Massoud, the great Pashtun commander Abdul Haq, Zahir Shah, Pakistani ISI generals, and of course American players. It's just a marvelous performance. And if you haven't seen it, and if they're playing it again, I urge all of you to try to attend. For the next hour or so, we're going to discuss 2 of the most challenging issues facing our country today. That is, of course, Afghanistan and Pakistan. In Afghanistan, we're in the midst of a transition phase of transitioning security responsibility to the Afghan National Security Forces to defend their own country as we draw down American troops and eventually pull out all of our conventional troops by 2014. In my opinion, we should have been doing this from the very beginning after 9/11. We should have started training the Afghan army in a big way, but we'll get into that later. At that time, instead of playing catch-up ball today with 98,000 American troops in Afghanistan. So Pakistan, too, is a big problem that we're facing in the region, and we'll go into that later, too. What are we reading, indeed, in the headlines today in our newspapers, and those of you that watch PBS and CNN are catching these same emphases, and probably, as you've noticed, the main focus has shifted from Afghanistan to Pakistan and Pakistan's covert policy inside Afghanistan, and not only inside Afghanistan, but on global terrorism. People are in the headlines and TV stations, talk shows are beginning to question Pakistan's role in the struggle against world terrorism and inside Afghanistan. We've known for years, even before 9/11, that Pakistan's army, which dominates the Pakistani state, not a civilian government, but the Pakistani army, since Zia-ul Haq, the then military dictator back in 1977, hung the prime minister of the time, that the Pakistani army and its intelligence agency, known by its acronym, the ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, has been operating religious terrorist sanctuaries inside Pakistan near the Afghan border, which churn out thousands of radical jihadists across the border every week, every month into Afghanistan. These sanctuaries and their military training bases along the frontier in Afghanistan are a threat not only to Afghanistan and the region, India included, Kashmir, but also on global terrorism. Faisal Shahzad was a Pakistani who was trained in northern Pakistan and North Waziristan. And last year, he attempted to plant a bomb in a vehicle in Times Square. The bomb failed to go off. It malfunctioned. He was caught and arrested and sent away to a prison for life. But it symbolizes the terrorist problem. Now, I'm not unveiling a scare tactic here. It's true. This is a big menace that we're going to be following in our country and in the countries of our allies and in the world during this century is a scourge of international terrorism, which struck us on 9/11, almost struck us last year again, has hit European cities. Most Muslim countries have also suffered from the terrorism emanating from Afghanistan and Pakistan. Of course, after the United States and Afghan forces, militia forces, drove the Taliban and Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, the main area that is sprouting terrorism has been in northern Pakistan. The two most dangerous Afghan religious terrorist organizations are the Haqqani Network, which has been in the news very much recently. It's stationed in the middle sector of the Afghan-Pakistani border, and it's made up mostly of a family, the Haqqani family, in terms of its leadership, but they also, under ISI direction and training of their followers, is very potent, a very dangerous group. Hillary Clinton, a couple months ago, announced that we're in the final stages of considering whether or not to put the Haqqani Network on the State Department list of foreign terrorist organization, the FTO list. The Quetta Shura is the second most dangerous Afghan organization, and we're all familiar and heard about at least Mullah Omar, the head of the Quetta Shura. Recently, the Pakistani ISI moved him south into Karachi, away from the frontier, where he might have been droned. But that organization operates into southern Afghanistan, and indeed in a sweep all the way over to northern Afghanistan, whereas the Haqqani Network focuses on the eastern Afghanistan right up to Kabul. The front page articles on September 21 reported that the head of the Peace Council of the government of Afghanistan, who's charged with negotiating a reconciliation agreement with the Taliban, was assassinated by the Taliban and assassinated by the Quetta Shura agent, who was sent up with a note supposedly from Mullah Omar on how to proceed along the peace track. That gentleman had a bomb in his turban, and when he met Rabbani, he set off his bomb. He's a suicide bomber and killed Rabbani, whose task was to negotiate a peace agreement with the organization that he came from. That does not show that there's much process, at least from the Taliban side and the Pakistani side, too, for this negotiating process. In September, which was the anniversary, of course, of the 9/11 attacks, on September 13th, the Haqqani network attacked the U.S. Embassy in Kabul and also the NATO headquarters in Kabul, which were nearby, and both were near the palace, they did not kill any Americans, but they killed a number of Afghan civilians. The Taliban also attacked an American base south of Kabul in September with a 1,500-pound truck bomb, and wounded 77 Americans and killed a lot of Afghans as well. And of course, you're all familiar with the raid that we undertook, the U.S. government did, without informing the Pakistani government. On May 2nd, our special forces flew 100 miles into Pakistan without telling the Pakistani government that we were coming into their country, because we couldn't trust them if the special forces would have arrived at Osama bin Laden's compound and the Pakistani government had been alerted, there was a real possibility, and indeed a probability, that Osama bin Laden would not have been there. So we did not inform them. Special forces landed. They killed Osama bin Laden, who was America's most wanted man, and whom the Pakistani military had constantly told us, he's not in Pakistan, we can assure you of that. He's in Afghanistan or someplace else. After killing him, we took him back to the base in Afghanistan and then flew over the Indian Ocean and dumped his body in the deep blue sea. Now, for the first time in 20 years, Americans, after these incidents, especially in September, the American government has begun to speak out in public against the Pakistani army's terrorist sanctuaries in Pakistan and to publicly question whether or not Pakistan is an ally in the struggle against terrorism. And this is a big step, because myself and others for years, for 15 years, we've been pointing this out in the book I wrote. I document what the ISI in Pakistan have been doing for the last 15 to 20 years in promoting terrorism, not only in Afghanistan and the region, but in other countries. I had 500 documents declassified in writing this book. It took me 8 years to write it. I sought to fill this knowledge gap about what's happening in Afghanistan, and there's still a lot of misunderstanding about Afghanistan and the United States, and what Pakistan was up to, and to lay out what we need to know to now succeed in Afghanistan. And the last chapter of the book is entitled The Way Ahead, in which I lay out proposals for the United States government and its allies to follow to succeed in Afghanistan. At any rate, at the end of September, Admiral Mullen, who was then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he retired on October 1. He was thoroughly frustrated with Pakistan's generals, whom he dealt with very closely. We had a soft approach up until recently of providing great amounts of funds and making statements that we are close allies and we trust the Pakistanis. The military assistance has topped $10 billion to the Pakistani army, and its army chief, Kayani, military requests over the last decade. About $7 billion has been promised or passed to Pakistan over the last 10 years in economic aid, and about $10 billion has gone, you don't read about it in the newspapers, in covert aid from the CIA directly to the ISI, thanks for helping us in the war on terror. Unfortunately, most of the ones that we've caught in Pakistan have been middle or low level types, and the senior Al-Qaeda types that we have occasionally caught were captured after we informed the Pakistani military intelligence about the signals intelligence, you know, the interceptions of their phone conversations, things. We said that there's this guy, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was a mastermind of 9/11, a Pakistani, who was hiding in a Pakistani military garrison town, Rawalpindi. And we told the Pakistanis, this guy is in this house. And so they had to agree. And then we had a joint raid, and we captured him. And we've had him. He's at Guantanamo Bay now. So the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, before he retired, Admiral Mullen, told the U.S. Senate committee at the end of September that the Haqqani network, quote, acts as a veritable arm of Pakistan's Inner Services Intelligence Agency. And that's the network which attacked our embassy and U.S.-led NATO command headquarters in Afghanistan. With friends like that, who needs enemies? He charged that there was evidence that the Haqqani network, quote, with ISI support, unquote, attacked the U.S. embassy and NATO headquarters in Kabul. We also intercepted phone conversations by the suicide attackers, bombers, whatever you want to call them, between them and a senior member of the Haqqani network, Badruddin Haqqani, who was instructing them on how to proceed, and they'd ask him questions and give him status reports. We intercepted all of those conversations, so it was quite clear who was behind that attack. In October, Secretary Clinton traveled to the region, and she brought along the new CIA, head of the CIA, General Petraeus, and high-level military officials, and she sat down with the Pakistani military and civilian leaders, who latter have very little influence, and told them that you have to close down these sanctuaries in Pakistan that threaten not only Afghanistan, but the world. Also in October, the next month, Senator Carl Levin, sorry, last month, chairman of the Armed Service Committee, declared in a speech, and I quote, "It is unacceptable for the United States to spend its blood and treasure so that Afghanistan does not once again become a breeding ground for militant Afghan extremists while Pakistan protects terrorists who cross the border to attack us." And at the end of last month, the Pentagon issued its biannual mandated report to Congress on the situation in Afghanistan. And I just read one quote from it. It was very tough on Pakistan. Quote, "Safe havens in Pakistan have become the most important external factor sustaining the insurgency in Afghanistan," unquote. That's a very blunt, high-level statement aimed at the Pakistanis and others, too. On Pakistan's attempts to control the Afghan government-Taliban reconciliation process, the report concluded, quote, "Pakistan seeks to play a dominant role in the peace and reconciliation process." Their tactics, of course, are both political and military. Their end goal is to establish, once again, to put the Taliban back in Kabul, to impose a radical Islamist government on Afghanistan, which is not a radical country. Its religion is mild Islam, and its politics are moderate tribal. This ideology that came in from the Gulf during the war against the Soviets and afterwards is alien to both Afghan political and religious traditions, although it has rooted itself quite firmly in Pakistan. What does all of this tell us? Mainly that Pakistan is the latest player in the great game, the title of this play last night. The Great Game is a term that was coined by a British colonial official in the 19th century, and which posited Afghanistan as sort of the inner circle, and the outer circle is made up of empires and larger countries which attempt to dominate the center of Eurasia, which is the Afghan highland. It's a very strategic area. I was on the Jon Stewart Show on July 28th, and he asked me, "Why is Afghanistan always getting invaded?" And I answered, the reason is that these more powerful states near Afghanistan seek to dominate the Afghan area, this mountainous area, and look down on its rivals and put them at a disadvantage, or to deny the Afghan highland to its rivals, its great power rivals in the area. Over the centuries then, especially, I'll just mention briefly the last four centuries. In the 17th century, the Mughal Empire in India and the Persian Safavid Empire in present-day Iran fought over Afghanistan inside the country. When you've had periods of relaxation of pressure on Afghanistan's periphery through history, then there's been progress each time in nation building inside the country. And that happened in the next century, the 18th century. British were still in southern India, making their way north, conquering India. The Mughal Empire was in decline. The Safavids were in decline in Iran. And the Russians had not yet entered Central Asia above Afghanistan. They were still in the Caucasus and Siberia, sort of lapping up territory for the Russian Empire. So Afghanistan had a respite from outside pressure. The modern Afghan state was formed at that time by a tribal leader from the south named Ahmad Shah Durrani of the Popalzai tribe. The book goes into detail on this. I won't go into detail here. I'll just mention that he also not only built a nation at that time, united Afghanistan, but he also created an empire that lasted for about 50 years. It encompassed northern India and northern Iran, the Mashhad area, and Central Asia. Bukhara was a major city there. It incorporated Kashmir and also northern India. By the next century, the 19th century, however, the British had advanced up to present-day Afghan borders, and the Russian Empire had spread, sort of flooded into Central Asia. I don't know how many of you have read The Great Game by Peter Hopkirk, but it's a marvelous book about this period of The Great Game, the imperialism. And it was also covered in the play last night on The Great Game, too, this fascinating play. So the British went in to deny, the British launched two invasions into Afghanistan, and both times they got a bloody nose. Because you cannot, outsiders have a very hard time staying in Afghanistan. They invade Afghanistan, it's very easy to march into Afghanistan with a more modern army, seize Kabul, but then in these tribal areas in the hinterland, always an uprising follows, and it gets larger and larger over time. Things take time in Afghanistan. And you have 40,000 points of conflict against the invader. There's no center, a nerve center, that the invader can attack, because in the rural areas, these 40,000 communities, armed communities, are separate and sort of on their own, autonomous, living as they have for centuries by ancient tribal codes and conventions. So the British went into this beehive twice, and both times they got a bloody nose in the first and second Afghan war. So after the second Afghan war, the British and the Russians decided to call a timeout in their struggle for control of Afghanistan and make Afghanistan a buffer state between them. There have been other buffer states in history. There's been some. Laos was one in Southeast Asia during the colonial period, 19th century. Earlier in the 19th century, after the Napoleonic Wars, Belgium at the Congress of Vienna was turned into a buffer state between France and Germany. And after the Second World War, the United States and the Soviet Union made Austria a buffer state. That is to say, we pulled our occupation forces, U.S. and Soviets pulled theirs out of Austria and agreed to recognize the neutrality of Austria during the Cold War. And Austria remained an island of neutrality and peace right up until the final collapse of the Soviet Union in December of 1991. So Afghanistan played this classic buffer role between the British and the Russian Empire beginning in 1881 after the Second Afghan War, whereby the British and Russians agreed to call off their competition to focus on the rising power of Imperial Germany in Europe, which was threatening both countries in their heartland of Europe. British and Russian cartographers drew present-day Afghan borders. These teams of Brits and Russians went out into the Afghan highland and coordinated with the Afghan emir at the time, leader of Afghanistan, a religious term, the head of state of Afghanistan to emphasize his religious pedigree. And they drew the northern boundaries of Afghanistan, the southern boundaries, and I don't know if you have maps at your table, but there's a sliver of land that separated the British and Russian empires. It looks very funny and different. It borders on China. There's only a 50-mile border with China. Why did the British and the Russians draw this map in their during this imperialistic era with this sliver of land out there, sort of out there in the Pamirs and the mountains? And the reason they did it was, again, to ensure that their military forces would not clash, that their own empire's borders would not come together. Now, during this period, which lasted 100 years of a second period of relaxation from outside pressures, lasted from 1881 to the communist coup, KGB-assisted coup, in 1978, and thereafter, within several months, the Soviet invasion of 1979, which was the Soviets attacked Afghanistan during the Cold War in order to deny it to the Americans during that period, just as the British launched two invasions into Afghanistan in order to deny it to the Russians. At any rate, this period saw really a flowering of modernization in Afghanistan. How many of you have read The Kite Runner? Yeah, quite a few of you. It gives you a snapshot of Afghan society at the time in Kabul, and it reflected the socioeconomic and modernization status of a lot of the more advancing states in the Muslim world at the time. Kabul was pretty much looking like Cairo or Ankara in Egypt, where women were not wearing the burqa on the streets. Indeed, they were wearing short skirts, and at any rate, the younger women. But Western clothes were worn by women and men. There was a secular education system, not a religious education system. From Kabul University, which had 20,000 teachers and lots of American professors were working there, all the way down to the elementary school, there were madrasas that the government supported and kept a close watch on, but the 90% of the investment in education was in this secular system. And when students, including women, this was co-ed too at the Kabul University, but at the high school level, you had girls and boys schools in Kabul and other cities. And it's co-ed too at the education system at the elementary level today, much like it is today, because what the structure that today is based on what was in place. For that era of tranquility, it was from 1929 to 1978-9 when modernization spurted forward. It also moved into the democratic era. In 1964, the Afghans put together a constitution which was based on the French and American models, and there were two parliamentary elections in the country. The 2003 constitution, which was done after 9/11, is based on this secular constitution that was done in 1964. Because Afghans today, especially the older and sort of middle generations, they look back at this pre-Soviet invasion, pre-Taliban invasion, as the era of tranquility, one that they want to return to and see an end to the war. The Soviet invasion lasted in occupation of Afghanistan, lasted 9 years, and the Soviets withdrew in 1989 after not being able to control Afghanistan for military and political reasons, which I go into in the book. After the Soviets left, we were hoping, and indeed American policy was, and so was formal Pakistani policy, they would also parrot this, that we want a political solution, let the Afghans choose their own way forward. They can have elections like they've had in the past, or they can have what the Afghans call a Loya Jirga, which is a countrywide council that brings all the tribal elders together, and clerics and other notables in the country, to make a decision, a very important decision. Like right now, a Loya Jirga is taking place as we speak here in Kabul on whether or not to move forward with the U.S.-Afghan Strategic Partnership Agreement. That will go on for a couple days. And also, it's going to decide how to proceed in the peace process when our peace negotiators are getting blown up by ISI-supported terrorists that are based in Pakistan. So Pakistan's pivot into Afghanistan was to get a military solution to the war, to put their own proxies, the radical Islamic types. In this case, at the beginning, it was Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was a major player in the play last night, the most anti-American Mujahideen leader during the resistance, who received most of the American weapons and money during the war against the Soviets and after the war against the Soviets, because the ISI wanted to impose a radical Afghan leader who had very little support inside Afghanistan, tribal Afghanistan, on the Afghan throne. This practice of choosing Afghan leaders, which the Soviets had tried, and the British had tried, and now the Pakistani tribe are trying, is bound to fail. There's a story that was told to me by Abdul Haq, the great Afghan commander, on my first trip to the region back in 1989. About why you Americans should not choose Afghan leaders, because that's sort of a briar patch that you should not enter. I refer to it as the Afghan political cauldron because it's filled with tribal politics. And Americans, Soviets, even Pakistanis cannot understand what goes on in the Afghan political cauldron. It's always roiling. It's always operating at the 15th, 16th, 17th level. We can't get beyond the second level. And they're always in touch with each other. They don't really have, they're tribal, they don't have really much ideological loyalty in any direction, like to communism or to a religious cause, although they're very strong, strongly Islamic. It's indelible in their personality, in their religion. But, of course, there's a question, as we face in Christianity, which Islam? And I devote two chapters in the book to describing the various currents of Islam. The Islam that came in from Saudi Arabia, along with lots of petrodollars during the first 20, 30 years. And it's continuing today, and it's going to continue to support these radical madrasas on the frontier in Pakistan, which train young Afghans, Pakistanis, Arabs, Uzbeks, Chechens, in ideology of hatred, not only towards non-Muslims who are infidels, but also Muslims who do not practice their version of Islam, who are also infidels and must be killed, like Shia, for instance, or Sufi. Hanafi is the progenitor of the most liberal school of Islam. It supports democracy, and a Muslim man can marry a non-Muslim woman. It's very flexible, and not least doctrinaire of all of the four major juridical orders of Islam. He was born in Chadikar in northern Afghanistan, or his family went to Baghdad, where he grew up, and he formulated the Hanafi code jurisprudence in Islam. In Afghanistan's constitution in 1964, just mentions that Afghanistan follows the Hanafi, this mild version of Islam, not the radical version. And the greatest Sufi poet, how many of you have heard of Rumi? Yeah, quite a few of you. He was born in Balkh, and his parents picked him up and the rest of the family and moved to Turkey, present-day Turkey, when the Mongolian hordes were advancing on Balkh, which was a good decision because the Mongolians took every man, woman, and child out of the city and massacred them all. But going back to Abdul Haq and his lesson to me on my first trip to the region, he said that all foreigners who choose Afghan leaders, who try to tell us what to do or try to dominate us, it never works. And he compared such foreigners to a merchant in a bazaar in South Asia who measures food or other things that people are out to buy on one of those weighing scales with two trays that you hold at the middle with a little chain. And there's a weight on one side, and then the merchant puts the food product or whatever on the other side, and then he gives the price. So Abdul described Afghans in this sort of anecdote as frogs. He said, What the foreigner tries to do, and this the British tried it, Soviets tried it, and it never works, is to put a number of frogs on one tray, several frogs on one side, and then to balance it with more frogs on the other side. However, while he's putting the frogs on the other side, the frogs on this side start hopping off. So the foreigner then reaches down for more frogs and puts them on that side, but by that time, the frogs on this side are jumping off. And the foreigner gives up because he can never succeed. It's a hopeless task. So you Americans should not proceed in that direction. Now, when Pakistan pivoted into Afghanistan, we had pretty much forgotten about Afghanistan during the Clinton administration. And we still were duped by Pakistan, which was operating covertly through these sanctuaries. And Osama bin Laden then was filtering into their system. I have a chapter, The Unholy Alliance, where ISI created this melange of radicals that included al-Qaeda, the Taliban, who were a junior partner, Pakistani religious parties with their religious terrorist organizations, which were trained and actually created and trained by the ISI. So this unholy alliance, finally the ISI succeeded because America was looking the other way and putting it in Kabul and controlling a lot of the country. But only in the urban areas, because the Taliban, who were also Pashtuns and tribal, they permitted the rural communities to continue to rule themselves as they had always ruled themselves in the hinterland. They did not want to spark another uprising. But this allowed al-Qaeda and ISI to set up training camps inside Afghanistan, literally scores of them, huge training camps, and radical Muslims especially, but also others from all over the world that wanted to commit terrorist acts came to Afghanistan and underwent training in these camps. I talk about this also in a chapter in the book called Zia's Vision. What his outlook was to dominate not only the Pakistani state, this first Pakistani military dictator, and his subsequent successors have followed this policy, to create Islamic depth against India, whereby Afghanistan will be a radical Islamic country piled on top of Pakistan, and therefore a weight against Hindu India. And Zia used to pull out a map in his office and show like-minded visitors the Central Asian republics of the Soviet Union, later independent Muslim states, above Uzbekistan, the various stans. Someday the jihad would move up and also take over those states and bring Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia into a Pakistani-dominated confederation to create a strategic depth against India. Of course, all of this helped the Pakistani, this Islamization side, to help the military to keep the secular democratic parties in Pakistan at bay and out of power, which was the main purpose. And it also permitted the military to keep control of the national budget, by which 60% every year went into military coffers and other areas like education, et cetera, suffered. Now, this unholy alliance began to launch attacks against Saudi Arabia during this period, the Saudi royal family, because they wanted to convert Saudi Arabia into a radical, aggressive Muslim state in the world to fund the jihad in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world. So they turned, Osama bin Laden turned against the Saudi state and began to call the Al Saud dynasty infidels, and they had left the path of Islam. He charged in his various pronouncements. The attacks against us from Osama bin Laden's bases in Afghanistan began in 98, when two of our embassies were destroyed in Africa by Al-Qaeda suicide bombers in Kenya and Tanzania. In 2000, they struck the American warship Cole in Yemen. And then, of course, 9/11 occurred in 2001 in September. During this period, we virtually outsourced our policy to Pakistan because we trusted Pakistan that they were like-minded in terms of Afghanistan, and they denied constantly that they were supporting the Taliban. This one ISI chief told our Deputy Secretary of State in Washington in a meeting, which is I got declassified, that not one single bullet is going from us to the Taliban, which was, of course, a huge lie. It's not a big lie. It's a huge lie. And I'm afraid the CIA messed up, too, because they began to look for Osama bin Laden inside Afghanistan, but those operations were undertaken from Pakistani territory, from our station in Pakistan. And of course, the ISI was on top of everything that they were attempting to do. They were hiring Afghan tribals to find out where Osama bin Laden was. And of course, all of those efforts were not successful, as were the letters from Clinton to then the military dictator in Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf. And also his phone calls to Pervez Musharraf, that why don't you help us get bin Laden? Because covertly they were protecting him like they protected him in Abbottabad. It was the same thing back then. They had no desire for the Americans to capture Osama bin Laden at that time. Bush continued that practice of sending letters to and calling Musharraf and asking him to help at least get the Taliban to detain him in Kandahar, which never happened. Bush's last letter to Musharraf before 9/11 was never responded to by Musharraf. Because he'd given a negative answer. We don't know where he is, and we don't have any influence on what's going on over Osama bin Laden and over Al-Qaeda inside Afghanistan. So then Operation Enduring Freedom happened, and we went into Afghanistan. We also, though, continued to trust Musharraf because he said, I'm with you in the war on terror. This is a dramatic announcement he made and criticized the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But in fact, when we went in and the Afghan uprising took place too and drove the Taliban and Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan because the Americans were finally coming in their mind, they went into their old sanctuaries in Pakistan where they'd been for 15 years before that. And the Pakistani ISI revamped, re-equipped, and rearmed the Taliban. And by 2005, they began to come across the border in hundreds and thousands. We reacted by sending more troops. So you had this escalation on both sides. As more and more Taliban were trained, more and more American troops were sent. And the war became an American war. This was a mistake because, as Abdul Haq would have told you, we should have stood up the Afghan army right after we drove out the Taliban and Al-Qaeda into Pakistan. But why didn't we do that? Because an American major general, I had his report declassified, it's also in the book, went out right after we defeated the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And he did a survey of what would be necessary to build up an Afghan army. Don't forget, the Afghans are good fighters. We gave them the wherewithal to defeat the Soviet army. We gave them weapons and money. when the Soviets were in Afghanistan, and they lost 1 million dead in the fight, but they stood toe-to-toe with the Soviets, who had not been defeated since the Battle of Stalingrad in 43. It's supposed to be 1943, an invincible army, but the Afghans defeated them, took great casualties in doing so. So we should have moved quickly, like we're not doing now, finally, and it's good that we're doing it, to build up an Afghan security force so that Afghans can guard their border. Ahmad Shah Massoud gave a speech before 9/11, and he was on a trip to Europe, and a European journalist asked him, "Do you need foreign help? We can send troops." And he said, "No, I don't want foreign troops. I don't need foreign troops. We know how to defend our own land." So we forgot that lesson. We went off to Iraq. American military units that had been very successful in special forces, especially in the war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that lasted 2 months, they were taken to Iraq. Lots of equipment, military equipment and intelligence gear were taken to Iraq. And when the Taliban made their comeback, who was in the way but these warlords who were very much into the opium trade? They were paid off by the CIA and military to defend Afghanistan because we didn't have any troops and there was no Afghan army to do that. And all of us have suffered, including the Afghans. As long as these terrorist sanctuaries exist in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, then war is going to continue in Afghanistan. We should use, however, our diplomacy and our military training, and we've got a lot of it, expertise and mentoring of the Afghans to guard their borders and to defend their country and not do it ourselves. We're now in the transition stage of transitioning to Afghan security responsibility for their borders. We also have to move away from the piecemeal tactical approach we've had in Afghanistan since the Bush administration launched Operation Enduring Freedom after 9/11. Our policy's been dominated by military and intelligence agencies. Let's get how many terrorists, or what about this guy behind this tree, or this guy behind this rock? Let's go after him. This is sort of the CIA mentality, and that's their job. The military it's always been questions of how many troops do we need, how much money do we need now to last and, you know, go through the next fighting season. We have, as I say in the book, we have discarded the idea of a long-term strategic approach by which the intelligence and the military arms will be serving our long-term intelligence, or our long-term goals, and not dominating, not deciding what a policy is going to be. We did this during the Cold War. Like after the Second World War, we devised the policy of containment. And the intelligence and military arms of our government were very important, critical to the long-range success. It took 40 years, but we finally succeeded when the Soviet Union collapsed. But they did not dominate policy. They were implementers of policy made in the White House at that time, and also the State Department, laid out by Kennan in his famous writings of the time on the containment policy. It was a very sophisticated, long-term strategic approach to a strategic problem, and the tactical side was subordinate to the overall strategy. Just a few more words on that. The military and military and the intelligence agencies deserve a seat at the table along with everybody else in making the policy. But once the policy is decided on, it's set, then they should implement that policy. One of the problems we've gotten into also, which I describe in the book, are stovepipes, where each agency is following its own separate policy, and sometimes it's contradictory. That happened during my time, and that's happened up until recently. Up until recently, like when Hillary Clinton went to Islamabad, she made sure that CIA and military representatives were seated on both sides of her. That was because of the Soviet, of the problems that we've encountered over the last 30 years in coordinating at the top a policy which everybody will systematically follow. Now, I have in the book, in the Way Ahead chapter, it's the last chapter, I lay out three main prongs. The first is on Afghanistan and dealing with the Afghans, and that is giving the Afghans responsibility for their own security and nation building. We become the supporting party like we had, like we did during the war against the Soviets. It'll be messy. It won't be like we like it, but they will feel that they have ownership. They have custody of the war. They have custody of their country. And if we can get back into that situation where we're supporting them, they then will, I think, stabilize their own country and defend it. I think I'm getting limited on time. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip a section on how the Pakistanis are having their own problems with the Afghans, big time. In fact, to a certain extent, these snakes, as Hillary Clinton calls them, these radical Islamist group that ISI has created for the last 20 years and runs their training camps and directs what they will do. Some of these snakes have turned against the Pakistani state. I would estimate in percentage terms it's about 10% of them, but it's going up. In other words, they were steered towards Afghanistan and other, India and other areas by the ISI, but the ideology got to them, and they're saying, hey, we're being used, and the government of Pakistan, these generals in the Pakistani country, are not Islamic enough. And so we're going to straighten that out. And they have been attacking military garrisons. They've been attacking civilian government buildings. And they've been attacking mosques of other religions, which they don't agree to. Now, the good news is that today, out of necessity, probably as much as choice, the Obama administration has finally created a new strategic direction, and that is of building Afghan capacity in military, political, and economic areas. The hour is late, but it's not too late. We and our coalition partners there's 49 countries that are supporting us inside Afghanistan, can still succeed in helping the Afghans to stabilize their country. This will serve our national interests, and it will stop this reenactment of what Senator Levin mentioned, that is the extension of the radical Islamist sanctuaries in Pakistan back into Afghanistan, where it would be even more difficult to suppress an ever-rising terrorist impulse from that area against the rest of the world. There's a subtext to that, too, and that is if the Taliban come back to Afghanistan, supported by Pakistan covertly, as happened in the 1990s, then you're going to have this return of all of the gender and human rights violations that were just horrendous during the Taliban period. I describe it in the book. I don't have time to describe it here. But Afghanistan would fall into this hole, especially in the urban areas of the Taliban strictures against women. And maybe many of you have read about that already, and I don't have to describe it. Finally, it would stop that. But finally, it would open up Central Asia, all of Central Asia, to the old Silk Road commerce that used to transit that region back at the time of Christ, 200 BC to 200 AD. The Silk Road was very active through Afghanistan, connecting China with Europe, and also north-south, connecting South Asia with Russia. And the Silk Road commerce exploded again in the medieval period when Charlemagne was, Holy Roman Empire was in Europe, and the great Tang Dynasty was in China. And it served not only those countries, but the whole region, including Afghanistan. So this is a concept, a vision out there of that Hillary Clinton describes as restoring the old Silk Road trading routes. In the modern era, that would be railroads, that would be roads, that would be pipelines, bringing Central Asian oil and gas to energy-starved Pakistan and India, and help in many, many ways. So shifting to the supporting role, helping the Afghans stabilize and defend their country and staying out of the Afghan political cauldron is the most sensible way for the U.S. policy to proceed now, and I think we're on that track. But it's not enough. We must also get tougher with Pakistan and their fueling of a radical Islamic proxy war inside Pakistan, inside Afghanistan from Pakistani soil. That involves not only what they're doing in Afghanistan, the captains and majors, U.S. captains and majors in Afghanistan along the border speak of the jihadi highway coming from these sanctuaries. It's very crowded even today, and that problem persists. Also, we need to protect our homeland from these training camps, which also produce global terrorists to come to the United States and also go to the countries of our allies. And we have to watch the Arab Spring as well. There's radical Salafist elements, as you read about in Libya, Egypt, that are trying to take over, Islamicize the Arab Spring. And there's democratic elements as well. There's moderate Islamic elements that are resisting. But these sanctuaries and the Pakistani ISI, they are in, you can be sure that they are in communication with those various centers that are trying to convert the Arab Spring movement into a radical Islamic movement, which would be extremely anti-West and extremely anti-U.S. and against our interests. So a tougher American policy on Pakistan should mix disincentives and incentives. In my book, I list 7 firm measures that the United States should keep in its grab bag and slowly apply if Pakistan does not change its policy and eliminate the sanctuaries. The overall goal should be to encourage Pakistan's generals to view the terrorist sanctuaries and organizations they sustain in Pakistan not as strategic assets to them, but as strategic liabilities. And that is possible. If we apply pressure, and also in terms of these snakes that are getting fatter and fatter in their own country and trying to overthrow their own government. So that gives you the prongs of the policy, Afghan and Pakistan. The third and last one, and I'll wrap up here, is the geostrategic prong. You know, this Cold War geostrategic vision that we now should establish and form for Afghanistan, and there are signs that we are doing that as well for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We need to use our tremendous diplomatic weight, which we haven't done to date, to build regional and global coalitions like we did in the Cold War to restore Afghanistan's classic buffer role in Central Asia, whereby all of the outside nations, including Pakistan, agree to exercise mutual restraint, as happened during the British and Russian Empire period in the 19th century. Now, the good news is also that on November 2nd, about 2 weeks ago, there was a very important conference in Istanbul, hosted by Turkey, but also we were a major force behind the scenes, bent on restoring the Afghan buffer, Afghan neutrality, non-interference in Afghan internal affairs, and respect for Afghan territorial integrity. Those are all elements in the declaration that came out of that conference. The conference included participants from the region. All of Afghanistan's neighbors were there, as well as Afghanistan. President Zardari from Pakistan was there. Also, the military representatives from the Pakistani army were there. The U.S., of course, was there. China, Iran, Central Asian states, key European countries like France and Britain, India was there. And this was the group that needed to come to agreement. It was only the British and the Russian empires in the 19th century. Now it's a broader group that has to agree to exercise this restraint and stay out of Afghan internal affairs and support Afghan neutrality, which could then finally end the Afghan wars. Let me just, before I conclude again, let me just read from this declaration a bit to give you an idea of what it says, where it's headed for. Support for the stability and peace in Afghanistan, as well as respect for Afghanistan's sovereignty, unity, and territorial integrity. continued support for the government and people of Afghanistan as they develop their country, combating and eliminating terrorism in all its forms and manifestations and violent extremism, and preventing safe havens for terrorists and terrorism in the region, dismantling terrorist sanctuaries and safe havens, disrupting all financial and tactical support for terrorism, refraining from the threat or use of force, and not to allow one's territory to be used against another. So those are the principal formulations in this declaration. Of course, it's yet to be honored in practice at this point, but it's a major step forward in the geopolitical realm. The end of this declaration notes that there's going to be another meeting in Afghanistan, in Kabul, in June. It's called an implementation meeting, so the monkey is going to continue to be on Pakistan's back to implement this accord, which is clearly laid out, which they are clearly violating, and this is all in the public domain. Now, there are many areas of violations. There's other meetings that are scheduled now in the next several months, which will also follow up on this Istanbul conference. There's going to be it's December 5 meeting in Bonn, and being that it's an election year, probably that the next NATO summit meeting is going to be held in Chicago, which will bring all the, you know, this is the most powerful alliance in the world. It's going to bring all of those countries together, and it's going to bring all of the others involved in the Afghan issue to Chicago, the major players as observers. So this will be very much on the agenda in Chicago. Anyway, the United States will be a major player in all of this conference diplomacy to bring peace to Afghanistan. The key question, however, will remain whether or not Pakistan executes a fundamental shift in its covert jihadist policy in the region and globally. The jury's still out on that. Many are hopeful it will, but today it's impossible to answer that question. Thank you very much for your patience. It's been a long speech.
Ambassador Thompson, thank you very much for this insight, compressing 100 years or so of Afghan and Pakistani history into 1 hour is a pretty good deal. We'll have to invite you back for chapter two. And really, it is an enlightening process to have a speaker like Ambassador Thompson speak to us here. And on behalf of the board and the audience and the World Affairs Council, we'd like to give you just a small gift. A pictorial memorabilia of your visit here to Anchorage.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, Ambassador's got his little treatise here on Afghanistan for sale back at the front desk. And Tori, would you mind holding that little book up? Makes for a little light reading. So in case you were wondering, and I'm sure we're all waiting for book number two to come out. And just a reminder, Ambassador is going to stay for some questions and answers. We realize it's after the 1 o'clock hour, so if you need to leave, please feel free to do so, and we won't be offended. Our next program is on December 2nd. It'll be Ambassador Henry MacDonald, Suriname Ambassador to the UN, and he's going to be speaking on climate change, forest conservation in the Republic of Suriname, and the way forward. So please join us for that. As you make reservations for this, please make RSVPs for that, because as you can see, we've got a very full room. And I just want to take a minute also to thank the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation for being a partner in our efforts, thanking BP for their sponsorship of our student lunches, and all of you who've been some supporting members of the World Affairs Council to allow us to bring programs like this to you. Let's see, is there anything else I need to say before I give the podium back to the ambassador? I think one more thing. We have a roving microphone because this is being recorded, so please raise your hands if you have a question, and the microphone will make its way back to you, and then we'll let the ambassador go ahead and respond. And with that, Ambassador, would you mind coming back to the podium to address questions?
Thank you. Thanks, Kerry.
Thank you.
So, thank you, Ambassador, for a very informative presentation.
Thank you.
Clearly, you've put a lot of emphasis on the Pakistani part of the problem. And to what extent is strengthening of civilian government and civilian institutions in Pakistan a potential part of the solution to this problem?
Actually, it's a key part of the problem, as you're indicating, because as long as the military in Pakistan calls all the shots on Afghanistan, nuclear issues, India, I think the tensions in these sanctuaries, which they've run now for a quarter of a century, it's going to be hard to proceed domestically in Pakistan to restore civilian supremacy. But I think the military has been very embarrassed by a number of things recently, and they've lost a lot of credit. Before, they were viewed as the only institution that works in Pakistan. But I think a lot of Pakistani centers of influence now conclude that the military has screwed things up. Indeed, the military screwed things up in 1971 when half of Pakistan broke away. The military tried to keep them as part of Pakistan by military force, that is East Pakistan, present-day Bangladesh. It was also, of course, a political problem, but the military proceeded with a very militarized solution, which just alienated the Bengalis and ignited the war, and they lost half of their country. So that was a previous case. The military went out of power at that time. There was a military dictator in power. This could happen again, where the military is so embarrassed by the setbacks, especially the worldwide publicity and the isolation of Pakistan and the idea that Pakistan enjoys a pariah status now in the world because of all this publicity, that they might step back from exercising power and permit a truly democratic process and democratic government to come back. We can only hope for this too as well, but it might happen.
I don't understand why we're supporting both sides of the war. I mean, we support the Pakistani military, and the military supports al-Qaeda. And why don't we just stop supporting the military?
You know, that's a question that many ask me. And I think we're finally not being duped anymore, to put it another way, that we recently froze $800 million in military aid to Pakistan. And just the idea to publicize everything that the military is now doing, which is so clear now by our military and our political leaders, to show what's actually happening at the covert level, what Pakistan's doing, has been pressure on Pakistan. And they know that that trend is going to continue. These trend lines are going to continue. That is, we're going to continue to lower aid, especially military aid, just finish it. Which many are calling for now. Just why don't you stop it altogether, which we haven't done yet. We are also warning them privately about the terrorist organizations that they sustain. Three are already on the foreign terrorist organization list, three of these ISI organizations in the State Department. And we're going to, I think, put the Haqqani Network and the Quetta Shura at some point on the terrorist list, which would then qualify the country of Pakistan itself to be put on the terrorist list, because ISI is an official arm of the Pakistani government, which is doing this covertly. And if they're sponsoring all these organizations, obviously they qualify to be on the terrorist list. And indeed, in 1993, then Secretary of State Baker sent a letter to Pakistan saying that Pakistan is on the watch list to be placed on this list of states that sponsor terrorism, which is only limited to North Korea, Syria, and Iran at this time. So the pressure will build. It'll be building in economic areas because their economy is in shambles, the Pakistani economy. It'll be pressure be building because of these snakes that are turning against the Pakistani state, be building because of the economic isolation as well as political isolation that Pakistan's facing. Now there's a movement forward in Indo-Saudi relations. In Saudi Arabia, the royal family doesn't like these snakes because they're going after the royal family. But on the religious establishment side, there's a lot of sympathy in Saudi Arabia for the radical Islamists. And money is still flowing in that direction for the jihadi complex along the frontier, which ISI benefits from. But Manmohan Singh, the Prime Minister of India, visited Saudi Arabia last year, and an extradition treaty, which is aimed at terrorism, extraditing terrorists, was signed between Saudi Arabia and India. And King Abdullah visited India a couple of years before that. So this is worrying to Pakistan, too. And again, about being isolated also from Islamic countries. There's not one Muslim state today that supports this Sunni extremism coming out of Pakistan. So these trend lines will continue, including Indo-U.S. Normalization or improvement, rather, of relations. I can't, as I said at the end, I can't be optimistic and say that tomorrow the Pakistanis are going to decide it's in their own interests, including the military, to close down these sanctuaries. But I think the pressure is building massively in that direction. That's all I can say, though. Right.
You began by describing the success of the United States in Afghanistan. It's still not clear what the definition of success is.
What is what?
At the beginning of your speech, you were talking about the definition of success by the United States
right.
in Afghanistan. Could you distill that point? Because it's not clear to me now.
Yes, thank you. The book is called The Wars of Afghanistan, and it describes, as I mentioned, how we got to this point. And why the war is continuing. But now there's been, I wouldn't say it's a turnaround, but it's a turning that's occurring. And the core of the turning, the success that I was speaking of, will be agreement by all of these actors in the Afghan drama, especially Pakistan, Iran, China, and the other neighbors of Afghanistan, to accept Afghan neutrality and independence, and not to attempt to decide who rules in Kabul, one of their proxies. Let the Afghans decide. And the Afghans, in any case, will always decide. They will never allow the Pakistanis, as they've never allowed others, to tell them what to do in terms of who's going to rule their country. They'll fight back, but the country will remain in a state of perpetual war as long as Pakistan, other countries do that. So there has to be, like the Congress of Vienna after the Napoleonic Wars and the UN conference after the Second World War, there have to be some rules established. And there's been a precedent for that in terms of the British-Russian agreement in the 19th century to exercise mutual restraint and respect the buffer state of Afghanistan. There has to be a similar agreement, like international agreement like that, which will end the Afghan wars. And it'd be great to write another book, The End of the Afghan War, which you describe that process. But right now, I can't do that. I can't be optimistic either. And that's why the title of this book now is The Wars of Afghanistan.
Thank you for a very interesting perspective on this problem. Do you believe the ISI knew that Osama bin Laden was in Abbottabad when we invaded, killed, and took him on May 2nd?
Yes, in chapter 22 of the book, it describes Osama bin Laden's retreat from Afghanistan. He went into the Tortobora area in eastern Afghanistan, right on the Pakistani border, and he holed up there with about 1,000 fighters, Arab al-Qaeda fighters, plus his family, had his wives and children. Then he exited the Tortobora cave complex out the back door into Pakistan. And it was a long line, as you can imagine, of al-Qaeda types, including women, his wives on horseback and children, and then lots of fighters. And it was a mile or so long. It went into the last exodus. They had other groups that went out, too, from his it wasn't 1,000 all at once. But when he went out, he had a sizable group with him. And they went across the border into Pakistan. Now, of course, the ISI, which knows everything that's happening anytime along that border, their agents and their operatives and the ISI military officers themselves, it's a huge organization, 10,000 in it. And this guy was America's most wanted man. So obviously they knew when he came into their country in this procession. When we asked him, where did he go, Osama bin Laden, the answer was, we don't know. We don't control that area. You know, the big lie again came into play. So then we were searching for him for all this time. I was surprised that it took so long. But finally, we did find him in Abbottabad. And of course, the ISI protected him throughout this period, and they were protecting him in this safe haven, which was surrounded by 12-foot walls, this compound. There's no other compound in Abbottabad like that, and nobody came out of the compound. And finally, we found them there by messengers going in and out to bin Laden, and we were able to get him. But throughout that period, ISI knew exactly where he was. I gave a frontline interview in 2006, and I was asked that question. And I said, the ISI and Pakistan's generals know exactly where he is. He's in Pakistan.
What do you think of Greg Mortensen's work in Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Could you say that louder, please?
What do you think of Greg Mortensen's work in Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, I liked reading Greg Mortensen's book, and like many, you know, millions of Americans maybe, but there has been some controversy that some of you may have seen as to the, I think others helped him write the book too, how accurate the contents were. I don't want to go further than that, but I've just heard that. But I enjoyed reading it.
Have we given up on the drug war in Afghanistan, or has the press given up reporting it? And what's the status of the poppy production?
It's still very serious, you know, huge problem, actually, especially in the south, Helmand and Kandahar and Uruzgan, where most of it is grown. That used to be the Taliban heartland. Now we're reclaiming it back, and the Afghans are too. The Afghan army down is now, I think they're going to be outnumbering our troops in that very volatile region soon. Our military made the decision a long time ago again that we're not going to eradicate the crop, which we could do, because it could make the insurgency worse, because the poor farmers that produce it don't have any other means of livelihood. But the good news is that at my last reading, I don't know if this is still the case, over half of Afghanistan's provinces have now been declared opium-free by the UN, and that a lot of money and a lot of work is going into, and a lot of effort is going into this problem, and someday I hope that trend will continue downwards, and that poppy production in Afghanistan will not be a problem. There's a lot of great crops substitution programs from wheat to saffron that are being implemented. It's a work in progress, though, and the problem's still very serious. If you want to see the latest statistics, go to this Pentagon biennial report that just came out in October, and it's called Report on Progress Towards Peace and Stability in Afghanistan. And it'll just pop up in the DOD website, and you can go to the section on opium production.
I'm here. Thank you again for your talk. As you started off by saying, this is an enormously complex issue. Your 3-inch thick book could easily be 6 inches and not cover it all.
That's right.
And listening to your presentation, I thought for every point of optimism, I could think of one or two things for pessimism and vice versa. The only bright spot in a way was the historical reference to containment. If only we'd adopted a containment policy to begin with, in my view. But what hangs over this scenario for me is the situation of the Vietnam War. And I'm wondering what circumstances, why is it not also a plausible outcome that we'll be lifting Americans off the roof of the embassy in Kabul?
Yeah, I served in the Mekong Delta as a advisor to a Arvin lieutenant colonel. I had a 13-man military team at the time, and over, 18 months. So I saw the Vietnam War firsthand, and I've dealt with the Afghan War. In my opinion, they're two entirely different contexts. They're both very complex, and the complexities are very different in both cases. And there's differences in other areas. For instance, in Vietnam, we could afford to leave and say, okay, you know, you take over Vietnamese and try to survive. We could then continue on with our international foreign policy and domestic foreign policy. And Kissinger and Nixon did very well in making us putting us in the catbird seat of the Sino-Soviet dispute. And so this overlay, the containment type thinking, you know, this visionary geostrategic type thinking, we controlled the trilateral superpower relationship even before the Vietnam War ended, because both the Soviet Union and China were coming to us for us to cooperate against the other. So we could come out of the Vietnam conflict and be in fairly good shape, which we were, despite what happened, and not to mention why the war ended the way it did. We can't do that on Afghanistan, because if we do, we're in a heap of problem with this menace of global Islamist terrorism, which is going to get larger and it's going to keep biting at us. We didn't have to worry about that with Vietnam, but we have to worry about that in this century. It might be the biggest foreign policy menace or danger to the United States in the upcoming decades. Also, the North Vietnamese had a much better base. They had a whole country, recognized country, and the Soviet Union was pouring the weapons and money into North Vietnam. Pakistan is fighting a proxy war, but there's not this type of overt system of another country, and also, of course, there were sanctuaries in Cambodia that were putting pressure on the South Vietnamese. And in the end, it was a conventional attack from the north, not a guerrilla warfare, that overthrew the southern the southern regime. And I must say, too, that in the book it describes how the communist regime finally fell, Najib collapsed. It was because not the Mujahideen conquered the communist regime territories. It was because the Soviet aid stopped. The Soviet patronage stopped coming, the tanks, the money to sustain the communist regime in Kabul. That was in 1992. So when the weapons and the money stopped coming from Moscow, because we reached an agreement with the Soviet Union on negative symmetry. Sorry to go into so much detail, and I was involved in those negotiations. So we stopped simultaneously the weapons going to the Mujahideen, and they stopped simultaneously the weapons going to Najib. And it favored the Mujahideen because they were more numerous, and Najib collapsed. But it was not a military victory. And we're in a much better situation in Afghanistan for that reason as well. So to go into a greater depth, it would be like you mentioned at the beginning of your question, that it's a very complex situation in Afghanistan, and it's very different than the situation in Vietnam.